You're hearing all sorts of bumps there as we're talking, which is
that's why
all,
sound check.
All part of a regular sound check, guys, you know. But, you know, it's great. It's, to be honest with you, you need to pinch yourself at times about this thing now and then, you know.
This is John Farrey. We're at Ireland's biggest music venue, the Three Arena, where the artist John is responsible for is about to perform their biggest show to date, having sold the place out.
It's what he was born for, I guess, you know.
John Farrey is Nathan Carter's manager.
Once in a lifetime, probably, you will come across some person or something that you can say with total justification, that is just great. And that was just one of those moments, to be honest. And that's the truth.
I'm Will Leahy, and I've always been fascinated by the mechanics of the music industry, just as much as the music itself. The unseen member of any band is the manager. Behind every great artist, there's usually a great manager. But what do they do exactly? To put it in a shop context, does the manager do the rosters and cash up at the end of the day? I once interviewed Ireland's most high-profile manager, Louis Walsh, who told me...
A manager is a salesman, and he sells something, and he must sell something he believes in. I mean, I'm basically a go-between, and if I find something I think is really valuable and will really sell, I sell it to the record company, and then I get the record company to sell it to everybody else. So I'm a salesman.
It can't be as simple as all that, can it? And how does the money balance out? The model seems simple enough. Apparently, the manager gets a share of the pie, usually 15%. So everything that comes in, royalties, tickets, t-shirts, he or she takes their 15% off the top. Brian Epstein, the most famous manager in history, used to get 25%. Yes, 25% of the Beatles. He earned more than any of the other four. And he had a great way of justifying it.
One's profits from that 25% in this business are not really fantastic because my own personal expenses in connection with the management of artists are quite fantastic, really. Plus, of course, for that 25%, we arrange for them to have all their photographs, we arrange their transport, and the, you can imagine the telephone calls that we make on behalf of, say, the Beatles, which is sort of worldwide, really.
Mm. Immense telephone bills.
Tremendous, yes.
Well, I suppose a phone call to the States in 1964 was a bit more expensive than it is today. Over the past few months, I've spent time with some of the most successful managers in both Ireland and the world. Everyone has a different story. Like Seamus Casey, who gave up a permanent teaching job in 1962 to manage a singer for the next 45 years. That singer was Joe Dolan.
I'm in love with a girl who lives in the house with the whitewashed gable.
I was a national school teacher. I was always interested in music. Ben Dolan, Joe's brother, had started a band with Joe. I was friendly with Ben. At the time, because I was a teacher, we used to run dances in this out in Castletown Gagan. And I got interested in bands. Like all young people of my age, we all went to dances and we watched the bands. And one of the things I always wanted to do was to try and talk to some of the band fellas after. I don't know why, but I just liked the thing. And Ben Dolan then had this band with Joe, called themselves the Drifters. And Ben asked me, would I run a few dances? So we fixed up, we ran a few dances in Eden Derry, in small halls. And Ben said to me, would you be able to get a few gigs for us? And I said, yeah, I'll work part-time for you. So we made an agreement that, I don't know, I think he was going to pay me £5 a week to try and get some dates for him. So I did get quite a few dates. I was still teaching, and at weekends I used to go away anywhere around the country trying to find out things about how do you get dates and all this stuff. And suddenly the band, people started talking about them. And in 1962 or 3, the band decided to go professional. The band were part-time at the time. Joe was working in the Westmeath Examiner office. Ben was working as a carpenter. And it was just weekend things. But suddenly they started doing 3 or 4 nights. And then they decided to turn professional. Suddenly in 1963, I found myself disappearing every weekend with the band. And I began to... I just came over me that I didn't want to go teaching anymore. I wanted this new life.
This is the next century, where the universe is free.
It was incredibly exciting. When we became very popular, we, first of all, we were getting 50-50, and then we were getting 60-40 of the takings. So my job was to look after the money at the door, collect the money afterwards, and the money was divided among the lads and the band. Ben used to play the tenor sax. He used to hide the wadded dough down the neck of the sax after a gig. Suddenly I decided that I was going to give up teaching, just like that. Today, I don't think I would be brave enough to do it, but I didn't think of anything, only I just wanted to be in the show band scene. I lived with my mother, and she thought I was mad, but I just went and did it. I was never sorry. I was actually delighted afterwards. You know, suddenly a whole new world opened.
It all sounds very gentlemanly, doesn't it? It can't be all that nicey-nicey, surely.
This is a Victoria Line train to Brixton.
I'm in London to meet another former school teacher who since 1993 has managed, or some would say crisis-managed, one of the biggest bands of all time.
Hello.
Hi, Will Leahy from RTE for Marcus. Marcus Russell, manager of Oasis.
Well, I kind of came of age in the late 60s, which is a great time for music. Very early on, when I was about 15, myself and a couple of friends formed a club to bring bands down from England in South Wales. We were just 15 or 16. Luckily, we talked our local council into giving us a small budget and a venue, and we just got on with it. It was a fantastic success and learning curve, and we got some great bands of the day down, like Mop the Hoople and Genesis in those days, which was a big thrill for us. That's when I got the bug, to be honest, way when I was still in school in my fourth, fifth year. I got a girlfriend, gonna get married, the usual thing. She was a teacher, so I thought I'd better do something as well, and qualified as a teacher. Ended up teaching economics in the mid-80s. I never thought when I went into it that I was going to leave it quite so soon. I never stopped dabbling in with music, and when I was in college, to qualify as a teacher, I took on the social secretary role in college, which was in London, and it was a fantastic time again. It was, punk rock was just beginning to explode around the capital, so I took on my experience from school in promoting gigs and did all that in the college, and some great nights, Sex Pistols, The Stranglers, Susie and the Banshees, all those bands, and got, as a result of that, a whole new layer of connections in the industry. And then an opportunity came along with a good friend of mine, actually, who approached me, said, look, I've written some songs, can you know people in the industry in your spare time when you're not teaching A-level economics, can you try and get me a publishing deal? And to be honest, I was a bit embarrassed that these songs can't be much if it's my best mate, you know. But to my wonderful surprise, I was really impressed with the songs, and the short story is one thing led to another, and we formed a band around those songs, and I managed to get them a record deal, which then made me realise maybe I'm better suited to being in the music industry than the education world. So I just took a massive gamble in my late 20s and jumped ship.
Hearing only bad news on the radio.
The band that was formed was Latin Quarter, and they had a top 20 hit in 1985 with this song, Radio Africa.
I kind of ended up being their manager by default, almost. I knew enough to get by. I knew enough to get the band's career going. I found myself within 2 or 3 years being able to say to myself, at least if no one else, I'm actually bumping along the bottom in a living year, and I'm loving it.
As luck would have it, Marcus shared the same solicitor as Smith's guitar legend, Johnny Marr.
He said to me, do you want to meet Johnny Marr? He's just left the Smiths, and he's looking for a manager to handle his solo career, and I think you'd be a good fit. I was, apart from being hopelessly flattered, I was very nervous because he was a significantly bigger name than anyone I'd rubbed shoulders with previously. But it all went great, actually. Our first meeting with Johnny, it ended up being like a 5-hour drive up the M6 in pouring rain, playing music in the car for 6 hours, and we kind of hit it off and agreed to work together, which was a huge break for me. One of his collaborations was with Bernard Sumner, the singer from New Order, and they formed a duo called Electronic, by which time Johnny, you know, we'd built his own studio for him in his home, and they made a great record together, and I ended up being manager for that as well.
I've been walking in the rain just to get wet on purpose. I've been forcing myself not to forget just to feel worse. I've been getting away with it all my life.
So then that sort of plugged me into the whole amazing Manchester scene of the late 80s and early 90s, which was really very exciting, you know, fledgling scene with the Happy Mondays, the Stone Roses. I got introduced to Oasis through Johnny Marr's younger brother, Ian Marr, who was like 15, 16-year-old, who I used to see Ian all the time because he was always around Johnny's house. But he kept saying to me, you've got to see this band Oasis. Eventually, I went along to see Oasis play in a small pub, the Hop and Grape, I think it was called, in Manchester, with Johnny and Ian. So that's when I first saw Oasis. A couple of days later, I got a call off Noel Gallagher saying, I heard you were at the show, we're looking for a manager. Do you want a manager? The short story is I ended up saying yes. Look, I was connected around Manchester, and if you can believe this, you know, I did drop the name to a lot of people in the industry around Manchester. And they were like, you don't want to bother with our band, you know. If they were going to happen, they'd have happened by now. And it was, there wasn't one single person said, wow, yeah, they're great, you know. And I thought, well, I've seen them live, and I didn't think I saw the greatest thing on earth, but I thought, these are, you know, the potential is incredible. They already got their own songs. They've got a charismatic frontman. They've got their own sound. There's not a lot to do here, you know. We just got to get it right. Fair play to Noel. He just said, look, if you want to talk, I'm on a train in 3 hours. I'll be with you. And he came down to London. We had a great meeting, and that was it. And I felt totally capable at the time of what needed to be done. It was incredible because the band were like, okay, yeah, I remember saying to them first meeting, we're going to play every toilet, which is a euphemism for a rough gig, every toilet in Britain twice around if we have to. And they were like, we're ready, we'll do it.
So far, we've established a bit of a pattern. A love of music, and good jobs that are abandoned to throw in with a wild rock and roll escapade. We're back at the Three Arena, where Nathan Carter is sound checking for his biggest ever concert. His manager, John Farry, also held down a steady job.
I was a civil servant in the social welfare. I was affectionately known as the singing dole man one time. I gigged at the weekends and I worked during the day, and a Haddowy three-piece band at times, and then solo, and found myself getting busier on the solo circuit. I started to get a little bit of success on the songwriting end of things. Never managed anybody, and the management thing came along by accident. I literally bumped into Nathan Carter back in 2009 at a concert in Buncrana, at which I was appearing myself. I was watching this young fella on the stage, and I thought he just was brilliant, and I had never heard of him before. Sometimes you get a gut feeling about something. There's an indefinable thing which everybody, and it's an often asked question, it's called star quality. Sometimes you get that vibe, and we got that vibe that night, you know. And then we got talking after, and he was a part-time artist based in Liverpool who had recorded an EP, I believe, and was getting played on Highland Radio. Yeah, and I said, you know, it'd be great to put a band together, wouldn't it? We formed a company. At the time, we were targeting the dancehall scene in Ireland, which is very much dance-related, as in jiving and quickstep and all that type of thing.
We want to see us going from side to side. I want you to tell me why you walked out on me.
It is an older demographic, which is kind of an evolution from the dance hall days of old. It's very much a bread on the table thing, and we find ourselves, thankfully, at the top of the tree, so to speak, over a period of a few years. We had tough times. Well, we had very, very tough times. There was times we hadn't enough money to pay the band. There was times when Nathan didn't go on stage because there wasn't enough people in the hall to justify going on. He talks regularly about a venue in Slane where there was like 16 people in the venue, and we had to give them their money back and pay the band.
So walk right back to me this a minute. Bring your love, Tommy, don't send it. I'm so lonesome.
All of our manager's stories seem to involve one crucial piece of luck, and for John and Nathan, theirs came from an unlikely source.
We were in the studio one day, and Nathan had spoken about this song, Wagon Wheel, that he'd heard in a ringtone. He thought it was nice, and he thought it was very good in an annoying kind of way. And it turned out to be a game changer, you know. Happy accidents happen. Everybody loved it. And you had kids of 4 years old singing the song. It just came as a surge. It just surged all around from local radio, and really it just took off. The obvious thing then was to source a different market, because the dancing thing is very much weekend related, whereas the concert scene is, you can also be out on a Wednesday and Thursday night, and you're working with a different demographic. Young kids can't go to dances because of the under 18 thing, but there's no problem with them going to a theatre. From those humble days where money had to be paid back to punters that came in the door, right through to the level that we currently are at, and hopefully it'll go a little further. That's what you hope for. I think you have to believe, you have to work extremely hard, and you need that little bit of luck. And the harder you work, the luckier you get.
So while it would be nice to think that talent will always win out, sometimes it doesn't without that lucky break. Ireland's latest international sensation, Andrew Hosier-Byrne, had the most unusual of lucky breaks. He happened to be in the same class at school at St. Gerard's in Bray as Storm Desmond, the daughter of Ireland's most important showbiz parents, Dennis Desmond and Caroline Downey, the directors of MCD Promotions. Added to that, Caroline was great friends with one Mr. Louis Walsh.
I had seen him perform in school. He was in the same class as my daughter in school. I had seen him sing, I think, at the transition year, you know, they do the concert. And he did a cover of a Bee Gees song. I remember sitting there, the hair kind of stood up in the back of my hair, my neck. And it was Christy Berg's children went there, so the Daniel Day-Lewis boys went there, Van Morrison's kids went there. So it was a school, Phil Coulter wrote the school national anthem. So it was a school that had, it was entrenched in quite a lot of parents also that were in the music industry by default, I imagine, but just where we all lived. They would decide to do a fundraiser, and they'd asked me would I bring Louis to come out, and it was called the G Factor, and they were raising money for Africa, and he came out, and I said to him, look, there's somebody here who I think is incredibly talented. So himself, Phil Coulter, and the music teacher were the judges, and everybody came out, and they recorded, and I said to him at the time, I'm not going to tell you if it's male or female, but I think there's a kid here who just has the most powerful voice. And the minute he came on and sang, he just looked at me and just went, it's him, right? So that was kind of just a reaffirming what we already felt. Actually, it was my daughter who first brought Andrew's music home to tell me about him. They had gone on a retreat, and they were all sitting around singing songs, and she came back and she said, oh, my gosh, you know, Hosier, she refers to him as Hosier because there was a couple of Andrews in their class. And she came back and she said, oh, you want to hear him? Like, she said, I've never heard anything like this. So it was Storm, actually, who first highlighted it. Then I saw him in the concert, then Louis come to see him. But I'd asked him, I'd sent him into Universal. It didn't kind of work out. They did some demo tapes with him. But I wasn't managing him. I was just mentoring, I suppose was the word. I was just trying to help him because he was just a remarkable singer. They went and did the demos. They came back. It wasn't quite right. So off he went, and he retreated, and he started writing his own music and his own songs, and he sent me some demo tapes, and I just came into Dallas and just said, I want to do something with him. From there, then, he was put in with Ruby Works, and it started developing, and Dallas came and said, look, you have to make a decision on who you now want to manage him. And I think the assumption at that point from the family was that it was going to be me, and his mom phoned me, and I said, I'm going to do it. And she said, great. So I thought, well, you know, I'll give it a try. I know my limitations, and if it didn't work and I didn't feel like it was helping him, I would step down. I would have found a manager for him. And as it transpires, I'm okay at it. Take me to church, I worship like a dog in the shrine of your life. I'll tell you my sins and you can sharpen your knife. Offer me that deathless death, the good God, let me give you my life. Take me to church. Say it's an overnight success, but there's no such thing as an overnight success. He's been writing and recording for a long time. It came quicker than we anticipated. America certainly came quicker than we anticipated, but that's the way the music industry is going now, that, you know, the public can now decide whether you're going to be hit. And it's a wonderful thing. The public can actually break an artist before anybody else can. So by the time Take Me to Church came up, which was released, and you could have downloaded it for free, or you could actually decide whether you want to give 50 cents or a euro. It was put up for 3 months because he recognised as a student people don't often have the money to even buy new music. By the time that had began to move very quickly, he had 7 record labels looking to sign him, you know, on an international basis. So, and that came from the strength of actually putting it up on YouTube.
I watched the work of Mac in bold and boyful, toying somewhere between love and abuse, calling to join them, the wretched and joyful, shaking the wings of their terrible youth.
We did have the money to invest in Andrew, and we still do. We will now make his videos. We underwrote the tour when he went out, and I believe managers should put their money where their mouth is, and that they need to take the same risk. And if we're not going to invest heavily into the artist, why would I expect another record label to do it if we're not wanting to do it ourselves? So we invested a lot of money ourselves.
You'll have noticed that none of our managers so far have set out on a career path to actually become a manager. It just sort of happened. I'm in Mullingar to meet Justin Moffat, who was determined to be a manager, and a local pub band called the Blizzards were waiting to be found by him on his very own doorstep.
I had made a very clear decision here. I'm going to manage a band. I am now looking for a band. And I had trawled Dublin and Galway and went to, you know, new band nights and stuff like that. And it's my current wife, Marion, who was friends with Brezzy's sister, Julie. And we'd just started dating, Marion and I. And Marion said, look, you know, this Niall has put a band together. You have to come and see this. And I can remember it as clear as day, going to see them for the first time. And it was in a pub called The Ennell in Mullingar on a Thursday night. And I went to see them. And I'd say two verses and a chorus into the first song, I was going to manage them, and that was it. I obviously approached them. They were still sweaty when I was talking to them. And I said, look, guys, you know, we have something here. This is me. This is my experience. I'm keen to do this. Let's go, you know. And so we recorded an EP here in Mullingar, and we were so happy with the results. It was such a great recording. We agreed, well, I agreed that anything that I might have been entitled to or any little split the band might have got would go back into the business. I often refer to this kind of system as the elves and the shoemaker. Yeah, you know, it's prudent not to start dividing up. 60 quid divided up between six people is 10 quid each, yeah, which individually doesn't do a whole lot. But as 60 quid, you can do a lot more with it. So we agreed at the time, look, you know, we all have little part-time jobs, or we all have jobs as well. And we did. I was working as a floor layer at the time, you know. Everybody was, Justin, the guitar player, was driving stationery around. Everyone had a job. So we invested anything we made, maybe for the first 2 years. So, you know, when we ended up going to, for example, Glasgow to record those songs, particularly that first single, the money was there to do it because we'd saved it. It was a real simple business model, you know. Being honest about it, did we make a lot of money out of that single? No, we didn't. But the exposure we got was enough to get us signed. All of a sudden, our record was being played on the radio. I'll never forget. Let me tell you, as a manager, you will never, ever forget your first band's national radio play. And that memory will stay with me till the day I die. It was Good Friday, and Anne-Marie Kelly, who was working for Today FM at the time. Now, she used to do the very early morning radio shift. But because it was Good Friday, she'd obviously been filling in for Ray Darcy. And she gave us our very first radio play.
And this is brand new from a band from Mullingar. They're called The Blizzards. Yeah. And it'll be their first play on Irish radio. Love this song. Something really simple about it, actually. It's called First Girl to Leave Town. Here they are. I just
heard. It's interesting, but even that one radio play on national radio will stick you in the airplay charts. So other radio stations looking at the airplay charts go, well, who are these guys? I'm not one to give advice. Tell you how to live your life. I said, hey, there's nothing there for you but pain and fear. Live on the crest of chasing fame. If no one knows your face, then no one knows your name. I said, hey. All of this went towards the band's exposure, rising and rising and rising. And then a record company sees this. Hey, who are these guys? You know, they've sold, you know, 900 copies of their own single. They're filling gigs. They're selling tickets. So that is what a record company really looks for. They're looking for a band that can do it and that are doing it. Again, you have to remember at the time, for me dealing with the young 20-year-old artist as the manager, all I was hearing was the S word. Signed, signed, signed. Such a one's after getting signed. This crowd here after getting signed. So there was a lot of pressure on me as a young manager to get the band away. So we signed domestically to Universal Records.
Blizzards then started to explode in Ireland. Justin booked huge sellout tours and delivered hit albums, but like so many bands before them, the Holy Grail across the Irish Sea proved elusive.
Everybody kind of went in a wage at this stage. Wasn't a huge wage. That's the way we worked from then on. We were very prudent with our money as best as we could be in the early days. We saved it for the next part of the project, getting the band better known, doing the festival circuit and trying to break into the UK. And that's where we really needed that money to try and break the UK, which we never managed to do. But we gave it a good shot and we spent quite a bit of money at it. It just didn't crack in England. And I guess the band never really gave it enough time either. nowadays I often advise bands, you know, don't jump into England too quickly because it can destroy your soul. You know, we started doing these, I can only describe them as dreadful tours in England. Small little venues. I mean, we were going to play in, we're playing 2,000 tickets here in Ireland over to some little place in Hull where there's 20 people in the audience. But, you know, we were very much advised at the time, you know, this is what you need to do. You need to start again in the United Kingdom. And, of course, without a single biting in the United Kingdom, we were starting again. And we had to literally start from zero all over again. But it can be very soul-destroying. They call it the toilet tour circuit in the United Kingdom. The band at this stage, you know, had done about everything they could do in Ireland, they felt. I think they were probably very disappointed that things hadn't taken off in the United Kingdom. And then, you know, they just, I remember them coming to me in September, maybe September of the last year that we were together, and saying, you know, listen, we're going to take a bit of a break. Everyone's just kind of burnt out. It was very unusual to go from being insanely busy on a Friday to having nothing to do the next Monday. To see, you know, you'd be taking a couple of hundred emails a day, and literally within a week or two, all that just started dying. Shh. Take me. I have no regrets, to be honest with you. And I don't think the band have either. It just seemed to be the right thing to do at the time.
I'm on a search to find out what makes a decent music manager. And getting work outside your own market for your act is now added to the list. Another Mullingar man, Seamus Casey, had better success than most years before any of the Blizzards were even born.
When God created a woman for me, he must have been in a beautiful mood.
Joe said to me one day, he said, I want to record original material. So I had to try and find some original songs. It wasn't easy at the time, but out of the blue, I was in Pi Records one day, and this lady was there, her name was Joy Nichols, and she said, I've been looking to find Joe Dole as manager. And I said, that's me, you know. I was introduced to her, and she said, I've got some songs I want you to hear. So she played these songs, and I thought they were okay. I didn't think they were extraordinary. The songs were Make Me an Island and Good Looking Woman and two or three others. Lee Hazelwood and Albert Hammond had written them. And she belonged to Shaftesbury Music in England, so she was trying to sell her songs. So Pi Records said that we should do these, and Joe wasn't that interested. But anyway, we went over to London and we met other people over there, just Joe and myself. This is the first time in London we did this big studio, and the release Make Me an Island in England.
Take me and break me and close all your windows and doors. Shut me up, cut me off, make me an island, I'm yours.
Suddenly the record started picking up in England. It got into the charts, and within 4 weeks Joe was on Top of the Pops. Thinking back upon it, I was much more excited than Joe. Joe was the most extraordinary person. He just relaxed, even though it was very new for him. And when we went over, they said, Joe, you'll be singing live. He said, yeah, no problem. You know, we went over the day before. They decided that Joe should get a new suit. And the suit cost £500 sterling. In 1969, it was this extraordinary place where artists went to, you know. Which we didn't know anything about. We just paid for the bloody thing. That was it, you know. I remember we came back and Joe wore the suit back because we had to get back for a gig in Ireland playing in the Olympia Ballroom in Dublin. And he still had the suit on him. And when he got up on stage, the place was jammed. The crowd pulled him off the stage. And they pulled the sleeve of the suit. It was the end of it after one day. Joe would have sold millions of records. One single in France, he sold 750,000. It was Lady in Blue. they were the type of figures. And so, Joe was the biggest single seller and album seller in South Africa for about 2 or 3 years. And in Argentina, he was a huge seller in these places. And in Brazil as well. He had that continental voice that got through, you know, to the European people, you know. But I do remember being in London one time in the Galtymore and Cricketwood, the Byrne, John Byrne's ballrooms. He had about 5 or 6 of them in England at the time. We didn't pick up the money until the second last night, and I went down and I picked it up, got a taxi back to the hotel, and I must say I didn't sleep that night. I had about 24,000 in sterling on my body. So I put it mostly in my pockets, and I remember I put all the money under the pillow and on the in the bed, and I got up the next morning then and collected it all, and I put it in my briefcase then and took it away.
As we're on to money, I've come to Galway to meet a man with a reputation for financial prudence. Ollie Jennings has managed the Saw Doctors for nearly 30 years.
Doing just once would be enough for those who lost in life for love.
I came to university in Galway in 1972, and I kind of dropped out a bit. I wasn't that interested. But I started, for some reason, I started to organise a concert. There was no, in Galway in the mid-70s, there was no real music concert scene. So I organised a concert with a group, they call themselves Cultural Line, and we got 200 people. I did it in the Aula Maxima in UCG. I had no experience. I put up 2 posters and we got 200 people. I took a huge leap then in May of that year, and I organised the Chieftains in Leisureland. And I got 950 people into Leisureland at 50 pence in, and I made about 50 quid. So I got the bug after that. So I organised Everton Ant and Paul Brady, the Boomtown Rats, Loudon Wainwright, Botty Band. Subsequently then, Dave Donlan asked me to manage them. Now, I think I was person number 101 because I had never managed anybody, had no experience. I think the way Dave Donlan worked was it was on like fishermen, it was a share. You know, so if there was 5 band members and me, we got a share. The big problem with Dave Donlan was they didn't want to allow any money for photos or, you know, PR or any other things other than, you know, if we got £1,000 for a gig, say, in Loughrea, it was to be divided 5 or 6 ways. We were doing really well, and I was kind of saying, let's push on. But Dave Donlan said, no, we're not pushing on, we want time out. I was new at the game, but I had an intuition that we were rocking and rolling and that we had to keep going and that it wasn't the time to stop. But they felt it was a time to stop and I felt it was a time to keep going, and it came to a vote. I lost the vote 3-2 and I was gone.
Ollie then spent the 80s running the Galway Arts Festival and living in a house in Taylor's Hill. At the end of the decade, he found himself letting out 2 of the rooms to fellas in a band.
Leo came to live in the house here with me. We had set up Mockness, and he was working in Mockness, as was Pierce Doherty, and as were anybody who kind of was on the dole and wanted to get off the dole. They used to rehearse a bit down in Mockness, and they were doing some gigs down in the Keys. They did 4 Tuesdays in the Keys, and it was at that point that Mike Scott found them. He was out in Spiddle making Fisherman's Blues, and he'd come in, you know, they'd get cabin fever out there, and he'd come in, and he happened upon the Saw Doctors playing in the Keys. And there and then he said, we're touring Ireland, you know, do you want to support? They basically, you know, in cars, just toured, went around Ireland with Mike Scott. But during that tour, he said, I'm doing 6-week big tour of England, do you want to do it? And it's at that point that my friendship with Leo Morn, who was in the house with me, led me to kind of get them a loan to finance that tour. So they had to have some money. So I arranged with my bank manager, who was the Arts Festival's bank manager and the Mockness bank manager, to a loan for 3 grand. At that stage, the Saw Doctors asked me, would I kind of start working with them? I said yes, and I gave him my notice to the Arts Festival. Everybody thought I was crazy, you know, because the Arts Festival was a big thing at the time. I gave him my notice in March. The Arts Festival happened in July. And in September, we were number 1 with Eyes to Lover.
I have fallen for another. She can make her own way.
It's a fluke. It was a 1-in-a-million shot. But it was a great song. They're great lads. And I've worked with him now since 1990. We got a lawyer from Dublin to co come down and advise us. We had a meeting with the lawyer and we drew up a kind of a letter or a heads of agreement. The points of that letter were we would split money equally. Basically, it was a six-way split. There was a very important clause about songwriting. And basically, the songwriting was Leo and Davey in the main. They were willing to grant their songwriting to be put into the overall pot. One of the end results of that is when I Used to Love Her became a hit, we got massive amounts of money from Imro and PRS because I Used to Love Her was on the radio so often and every wedding band was playing it. But all that money went back into the pot, the Sought After's pot, to be divided six ways. And the reason for that was Leo and Davey wanted the band to stay together. You know, they wanted to have a stable band. And they felt by handing over the songwriting money, this would help over the initial years. But it was a very generous gesture by them. We had a leaving clause as well, that if you left the band, you got nothing. I couldn't say it was a very detailed contract, but it has stood the test of time. The partnership now is three. It's Davey Carton, Leo Moran and me, because we're the remaining three from that six that signed that agreement back in 1990 before I Used to Love Her.
Written, legally binding contracts, all above board then for the Saw Doctors. But would it surprise you if I told you that Oasis did things differently? They asked Marcus Russell to be their manager in 1993. In 94, they released Definitely Maybe, which sold 15 million copies. In 1995, they released Morning Glory, which sold 22 million copies. And in 1996, they broke the UK live concert record when they sold out Nebworth for 250,000 people over two nights. I bet their manager was glad of his contract. Today is gonna be
the day that they're gonna throw it back to you. The beauty of it all was they were very much happy to demarcate between being in a band and being a manager. So they were like, you're the manager, you get on with all of that. We're not going to second guess you. You know, the management terms are very simple, which I told them, that's what I want. We worked on a handshake for several years, for at least a decade. Everyone talks about contracts and deals and this, and I know it's obviously very important if something goes wrong. When everything's going right, and if everybody is genuine and trusts each other, you know, you barely got time to, you know, you're just building careers, and management is usually the last to get paid. The way the deals work is unless the band get paid, you don't get paid, you know.
It was very clear, even from that first meeting we had where we did up a little contract, the main thing the Sought Afters wanted was they would get a certain amount of money every week. Luckily, we had a hit. We had money coming in. And luckily, we were able to pay each other. I think initially we paid ourselves £100 a week. We managed, in the 27 years since I've been working with them, we've managed to pay ourselves every week. And every year we've managed to pay ourselves a little bit more. We had two massive hits in Ireland, which carried over into the UK. Irish people in the UK knew about the Sought Afters because of these massive songs, I Used to Love Her and N17. So the first time we went over, there was an audience. Even if it was small, we had an initial audience. We spent two or three years up and down the roads in England and Scotland for very little money. I remember playing Liverpool to 70 people the first time, Liverpool Irish Centre. And gradually we built it up. Virtually we made no money in any of those first, second, third years. All of that was financed because we had a kitty from I Used to Love Her. So I suppose we were lucky in that we could afford to tour for two or three years without money because we had this massive hit which gave us financial resources. Most bands like the Blizzards or the Stunning only went over once, it didn't happen, and they never went back again because they couldn't afford to, because you know they didn't have the hit like I Used to Love Her, and they had to go back to Ireland and play all the ballrooms to keep the money rolling in. It was different with the Sought Afters because we could go over once, lose money, because we had I Used to Love Her. We could go over a second time and break even, and a third time and a fourth time. We did Glastonbury in 1992, and the BBC Radio 1 picked up on it. One of the successes or failures of the manager is whether he or she can lift the profile of the band so that everybody's talking about the band or people want to go out and buy tickets in bigger numbers. Doing that Glastonbury in 1992 and having the look at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, that was the show that Radio 1, and they broadcast about 15, 20 minutes of it. Our stock went up in leaps and bounds after that. We did a festival in Nottingham, and our agent got us $100,000 for that gig alone. We never earned a huge amount of money in any one year, but over 25 years, we were able to pay ourselves every year. I know other bands who would have divided up all their money and not spread it out over a couple of years. Effectively, that's what we did. Or maybe that's as a result of me being at the helm, because I'm a bit cautious and I always save for the rainy day. And I suppose you might use the word prudent or cautious, but as a manager, that's the way I have been. And that's the way I have tried to guide the Saw Doctors over 25 years. I mean, we haven't worked. We stopped in 2013. And we didn't work again till last October, which is 4 years. But we still were able to pay ourselves for each of those years because we had saved up a kitty. And that's the way, as a style of management, that's the way I'm very old-fashioned, you know, but that's the way I've worked.
One artist did it in reverse. An Englishman who came to Ireland to build his career as he couldn't break it back home. Bernadette Barrett manages Lisa Hannigan, managed Damien Rice, and began her career on the management team of David Gray.
I actually went to work for Vince Parrott, the main fiddler, and I became the promoter of the main fiddler in Dublin. And then through that, went to the main fiddler in London. And I had met David Gray and Rob Holden, who's my business partner, through David playing the main fiddler in Dublin, where I just absolutely fell in love with Century Ends the first time I heard it. And had to do something with that. I just wanted to bring him back in to do some additional shows, and we did the first Irish tour. And David, fair play to him, the first time I met him, he said, whenever I can afford to give you a job, I'm going to give you a job. And I was like, yeah, whatever. And he did. But it seemed to develop its own little legs. I think people just really warmed to David and the music. White Ladder had been such a success in Ireland, the story had built enough to the point where there was some interest in the UK, so he'd signed a record deal in the UK, and Rob was like, I'm going to need some help on this, do you want to come and work with me? And I'm like, I've never done any sort of management or anything like that, but yeah, let's give it a go. So that's where I learned all the management skills that I did. I left the main fiddler at that point and I went to work with Rob full time in his bedroom. The next 5 years are a bit of a blur, really. And yeah, just sitting in an office on a stool, answering the phone on the fax machine because it kept ringing, as well as two landlines with no internet and no emails, or he had some crappy dial-up thing on the computer.
And to add to our ongoing series of lucky breaks, David Gray's was about to happen at Glastonbury, where a musical legend went missing.
David was playing on the Saturday afternoon and we had a fantastic show. Sun was coming up, it was like 4 o'clock in the afternoon slot, and then we got a phone call to say that Burt Bacharach had something had happened, Burt Bacharach, and he couldn't make the slot on the Sunday, and by any chance would we be available to do a main stage slot on the Sunday afternoon? We were like, yeah, we did that slot on the Sunday afternoon. The record charted on that afternoon, and we got the television exposure that went along with the Sunday at the Glastonbury. So I think that was a really, really pivotal point. And it's just all the stars aligned, where you're on radio, you're on television, you're playing the main stage at Glastonbury on the Sunday by accident. That was something to me that seemed like a game changer, and also one of the happiest moments of my life, just standing on the side of the stage, seeing that main stage crowd for an artist who'd worked so hard for 15 years to do what he was doing. And if you want it, come and get it, crying out loud. Love that I was giving you up, never in doubt.
I often describe it as having 20 ducks. And if 19 of those ducks are in a row and one isn't, and in many cases that one duck I have found has been luck. Yeah, being in the right place at the right time, you know.
Well, any manager will tell you, I would say luck. It was a lucky day that Larry Gogan played I Used to Love Her, because there was no marketing done, but as soon as he played it, people started hitting the phones and started ringing and requesting it. I mean, how lucky was it that Mike Scott happened to be in Galway when this very young, inexperienced band, not fully formed, were playing the Keys Bar?
The industry has eulogised some managers for whatever reason, but you know, there's so much luck involved. I don't think that's fair on a lot of the other managers who just didn't get the breaks.
And so it is
just like you said it would be.
Yeah, one thing a manager can't manage is luck. Bernadette Barrett started to manage Damien Rice. His homemade debut album, Oh, would go on to sell over 2 million copies. But that wouldn't have happened without director Mike Nichols including his song in a Julia Roberts movie. And that lucky break took place at a party.
It sounds really odd, but our American partner on the label side had invited us to do a pre-Oscar party in somebody's house in Los Angeles. This was very, very early days. I think the record had just come out. It wasn't even out yet in America. So we went to this guy's party. You're sitting in this room going, I know everybody because you know them from the screen. We had like 35 people, most of whom were nominated for Oscars, in the room watching Damien and Lisa and Vivian do their thing. I just remember looking around the room going, well, these are all these people. But it was like George Clooney and Nicolas Cage. And so that was a very unusual night. But Mike Nichols was one of the guys at that party. And he saw Damien and just really liked what he was doing. So it was one of those moments that changed a lot. But we went from like literally myself driving Damien and perhaps one or two others in my car from Manchester to Liverpool to Newcastle to having a truck and two buses on across America and stuff. So it was great. Well, on one record, it was a really interesting trajectory from start to finish.
And so it is, just like you said, it should be. We'll both forget the breeze. Most of the time.
It probably would be unfair to finish this quest without hearing some of the times when management wasn't so easy. One of the hard parts is to get your artist to do promo. This is the constant series of interviews with radio, TV and the papers that each artist has to do to promote an album or a concert. Damien Rice doesn't like interviews.
I think it was just so tiring, and there's a point where it's the artist's discretion, and I think as a manager you're kind of going, I'd rather you didn't do any promo than did bad promo. If you're going to be miserable, then what's the point? And I don't think it's very attractive to have an artist who's complaining about their legions of fans and their sold out shows and how difficult their life is. I don't think that's attractive or appealing. And I think if that genuinely is the person's position, then it's our job to... Was it Colonel Parker that said it's our job to save them from themselves?
You've got to know what your band is up for and what it isn't up for, what it's good at and what they find more difficult or what they find, you know, excruciatingly boring or something. So the first thing, if you've got to scrape someone out of bed at 8 in the morning, they've only been in bed for 2 hours, at least make sure it's for something that they feel is important and it's something that they're good at doing.
We never fell out, except sometimes when Joe would have a good few drinks of a night, he'd come in the next morning and some idiot would be after telling him, Joe, you should record this song or you shouldn't be doing this. And he'd come in to me and he'd say, I'm going to get rid of Ben and yourself. He used to call us the country of western part of his act, you know. Sometimes when he'd have a good few drinks, he'd be saying to himself, I should be doing something else, you know. He sacked Ben a few times and he sacked me a couple of times. And then the next day I might meet him and I'd say, how are you? Great, how's yourself? So one day I just said to him, there's no point in me talking to you, you sacked me yesterday. So he just told me to F off, you know, cuddin'.
9,000, yeah. Yeah, there'd be a good standing thing here as well.
So. We end where we began, at the Three Arena where Nathan Carter is about to take the stage at his biggest ever concert. His manager, John Farry, has never been prouder. I've heard words like trust, loyalty, honesty, understanding, but I suppose the most important word in the managerial dictionary is relationship.
We would have a very good relationship, I would like to think. It's almost like a family, dare I say it, father-son type of thing. You know, we don't always agree.
You name it, the manager does everything. Hairdresser, psychologist, counsellor.
Your job is to create a career for musicians. And I mean, to use a bit of an odd analogy, I'd say a manager is similar to, like in horse racing, to what a jockey does. You know, I mean, all racehorses are very different from each other. And, you know, it doesn't matter. A good jockey will know what kind of horse he's on and will know how to get the best out of that horse.
Yeah, you just want to protect them. And I don't know if that's a female thing, being a mother. You want to make it right for them. You just wanted to make it right for them because they want it so badly and they have a talent.
Won't you tell her, please, to put on some speed? Follow my lead. Oh, how I need someone to watch over me. Someone.